You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of All the Pretty Little Horses by Vincenzo Barney. So the heaps of money won by McCarthy set in motion a train of events that forever parted him romantically from Britt. McCarthy made several trips to Tucson to convince her to come back to El Paso, she says, but she couldn't bring herself to, though they would continue to stay in close touch, to varying degrees of intimacy, for the remainder of McCarthy's life. And McCarthy would later propose marriage, twice, according to Britt. They never came back together in full. If one wants to extend the influence of McCarthy's relationship with Britt onto his fiction, look no further than No Country for Old Men, in which Llewellyn Moss chances upon a satchel full of money, setting in motion a train of events that forever parts him from Carla Jean, who was 16 at the time she marries Llewellyn. The same age as Britt when she met McCarthy, and 19 at the time of the novel. Starting with John Grady Cole and Alejandra and All the Pretty Horses, a love that is a few tragic degrees out of true, McCarthy would spend the last half of his career in equal intimacy with Britt on the page, as in life. The letters during this period in the early 80s are buoyant with pain, and McCarthy admits resentment. I have to confess that in a way, I was hoping that I wouldn't hear from you anymore, one begins. I have to confess, too, that there are times when I feel enormous resentment toward you. Baby, there was nothing wrong with our love. You just threw it away. I never hear that song. I don't start crying. I never got over those blue eyes. I make lists of places in the world to go and things to do now that I have no responsibilities, but everything is just empty. We head back into the house. The windows wear the translucent paint of our reflections. Can I see some of the letters? She reads through a few, twisting her necklace. I hate to say it, but I think Cormac really did love me. We laugh. I had no family stability. I was homeless. I was vulnerable. I was young. I mean, she pauses and screws up her face. Who could blame him? I know the muse well enough to identify one of her shock jokes. What a groomer, she says, thrusting her hand up into the air and bust out laughing. There is a sense of heat ripple to the horizons of Britt's life after the split, the kind of interstitial oblivions between novels in, say, a trilogy. In conversation, we pass through gaps of haze and shimmer. She attends the University of Arizona. Plagued by her childhood trauma, she is interred in a psych ward where her uncle gifts her a Catholic medal of Stella Maris, a title for the Virgin Mary referring to her guidance and protection of seafarers. She works at bars, including someplace else. She becomes a nurse. She trains horses. She has a short marriage, but never a love again like Cormac McCarthy. She deals for the rest of her life with severe depression and low self-esteem. She is, in her own words, a lost soul. Throughout, she speaks to McCarthy multiple times a week and is visited by him regularly. Then, sometime in the 80s, McCarthy sends her the manuscript for All the Pretty Horses. The first thing I see, obviously, is the title, and I thought, oh my gosh, I started reading it, and it's just so full of me, and yet isn't me. It was so confusing. Reading about Blevins getting killed was so sad. I cried for days, and I remember thinking to myself that being such a lover of books, I was surprised it didn't feel romantic to be written about. I felt kind of violated. All these painful experiences regurgitated and arranged into fiction. I didn't know how to talk to Cormac about it, because Cormac was the most important person in my life. I wondered, is that all I was to him, a train wreck to write about? I was trying so hard to grow up and to fix what was broken about me. I still thought I could be fixed, and this felt the opposite of fixing me. Cormac called me and said, "What did you think about it?" And I said, "Well, I really liked the book. It's beautiful. But my kitten, John Grady and everything, it feels weird." And he just laughed and said, "Well, baby, that's what I do. I'm a writer." When she broached Blevins' death and how it made her cry for days, he said, "I knew you would, and I'm sorry." And I said, "Well, you could have let him live." And he said, "No, I really couldn't." And I felt like I was about 2 years old for asking him this. But I said, "Well, you'll still kill people for me, though, right?" And he said, "Yes." And that was enough. For the rest of his life, McCarthy would make visits every few months to Tucson and stay at the Arizona Inn. While the visits were made out of love and longing, they were always entangled with what felt to Britt like research, like an artist visiting his subject for an extended portraiture. One year, when she was depressed, McCarthy came out and taught her stonemasonry in northern Arizona. Later that year, he sent her a draft of his new play called The Stonemason. When Britt was taming a crazed purebred Babson Arabian at Bazzi Tankersley's horse farm in the 80s, McCarthy visited to watch her tame it and called her each night on the phone after he left to ask her about the horse. McCarthy himself may never have ridden, but the novels of the Border Trilogy teem with intimate knowledge about horses. They teem, too, with other impossible-to-realize 16-year-old love interests, such as Magdalena, the beautiful Mexican prostitute who steals John Grady Cole's heart in Cities of the Plain. The list goes on, most painfully culminating in her portrayal as Alicia Western in The Passenger, though Britt never suffered from her doppelganger's hallucinations. Sources close to McCarthy confirmed Britt's role as his muse and love of his life, including his biographer Tracy Daugherty. Michael Cameron is emphatic about Britt's inspiration. She was his muse throughout, throughout. She's Alicia Western. There's no doubt she was the love of his life and his muse. I mean, when you saw them together, they were so in love, just so in love with each other. Their time in Mexico was absolutely the inspiration for All the Pretty Horses, that impossible to realize love. I read one of the first typescripts of it, and I told Cormac it made me cry. There was no doubt about it. Cormac loved her, and she was his muse. She was the truest witness of his life. These fictional uses of her life, however, often led her into deeper depressions, punctuated, she says, by two marriage proposals by McCarthy. The first, at the Gardner Hotel in El Paso, was made several years before McCarthy's marriage to Jennifer Winkley in 1998. The second, at the Arizona Inn, at the time of McCarthy's work on the Counselor screenplay. Both times, McCarthy got cold feet. The second time, he reneged after finding out Britt's Catholic Church in Tucson would not permit a marriage unless McCarthy made a Catholic confession, which he refused to do. The dialogue of his proposal to Britt in the Arizona Inn, she says, is exactly recited by Michael Fassbender and Penelope Cruz in The Counselor, to her shock. "I intend to love you until I die," Fassbender says. "Me first," Cruz replies. Outside of her time with McCarthy, it is difficult for Britt to give her life artistic resolution. Starting with All the Pretty Horses, she would look to McCarthy for that. "I always looked to Cormac's books to see how I was doing." She takes a comedic beat, which was usually dead. In chronological order, we have, at the very least, Harrogate, Wanda, John Grady Cole, Blevins, Alejandra, Magdalena, Carla Jean, Laura, and Alicia, who is dead of suicide in the opening italics of The Passenger. Only Harrogate seemingly makes it out alive, with his face averted into his own pale reflection in the train window, taking him out of the novel. That sheer, ghostly reflection, in a sense, it's how Britt sees herself in McCarthy's mirrory prose, a ghost rising from the characters, the situations, the deaths, a ghost gaining some momentary purchase on herself. Her mission from the age of 11 was to be good, to survive, and yet McCarthy kept killing her. "I thought he must not believe in me," she says. "It's taken me decades to realize that maybe what he was doing was killing off what had happened to me, killing off the darkness." A strange thing happens in McCarthy's body of work after meeting Britt. It is visible at the tail end of Blood Meridian. Morality, not to mention commercial success, starts coming into focus. His worlds are still cruel and full of evil, but he begins writing about characters who display courage in the face of it, who, like Britt, try to be good, emulous characters, heroes even, who, beginning with the kid in Blood Meridian, had got onto terms with life beyond what his years could account for. The person, the spirit he's writing about, is Augusta Britt. Like Britt, his characters are placed under an obligation to survive and bear these trials with grace and dignity. McCarthy would often tell his son John, when speaking of his own cold family and violently abusive father, who would savagely beat him as a child, "The difference between you and me is that you were born a good person," John recounts to me. "I had to work hard to become one." If we take McCarthy's fiction as a measure, "Being a good person" seems much on his mind, starting with All the Pretty Horses, the first of his works brimming in augustal colors, created in that artistic wiggle room between frisson and fission. "Being a good person" seemed to be on his mind, too, when he took Britt, a victim of worse male violence than he was, away from the streets of Tucson. But as his characters started becoming better humans, in Britt's view, McCarthy, whom she always thought of as a great man, did not. As he dined with celebrities and reinvented himself in Santa Fe as a formidable intellectual, and a very rare intellectual, one who can learnedly contemplate quantum physics and work it into art with mixed success, Britt thought he turned his back on his oldest friends. He felt he'd wasted the last years of his life, Britt says. "We're up early enough to watch the sun unbraid the first permissive stars. Right before dawn, the mountains look soft as dress folds, and Britt is playing with the hem of her denim shirt." He felt slightly exploited by the Institute crowd, and I never saw him cry, but we spent a few nights up in Globe together right before he got really sick, and it was snowing, and he started to get teary-eyed, and he told me he regretted all the years not being together. McCarthy would go on to name Britt in his will, along with ex-wives Jennifer Winkley and Annie DeLille, youngest son John McCarthy, and Chase McCarthy, whom he managed to fully reconcile with in his last years. John and his mother, Jennifer, cared for McCarthy in his final years and were there with Chase the day McCarthy died. The last words on his Olivetti Litera typewriter read, "I don't know, Frank. I say we just leave him hanging there." There's no gentle summer rain in Arizona, no poised and delicate thunderheads. Storms come with the shock and awe of violent reprisals. By the time you hear the dramatic throat clear of thunder, hail the size of baseballs is upon you. Seeing as it's supposed to rain later in the day, Britt and I are heading over to the stalls to do as much as we can. All horses have two sides. "Well, that's a smart thing to say. Of course they do," she laughs, throwing her hands up in playful self-mockery. "But they have two sides to their brains, and they think and react differently on each side. The right side can spook at something that the left side walks by calmly every day. So that's to say you want to put the halter on their left side. Here, you try." Unless I'm unusually timid, Waltzing up to a horse I've never met before with daring nonchalance strikes me as a great way to get my head stove in, so I've been giving Scout a courteous distance. But Britt holds the looped purple halter out to me, inviting me closer. Oh, and don't ever put your head above a horse's. Horses have the quickest reaction time of any animal, faster than cats. They won't ever mean to, but they can startle and raise their head so fast it can knock you out or even kill you. So, no pressure. To tie a halter hitch, you've got to hug a horse. So I do, standing in the same direction as Scout and pulling the halter over his Roman nose until my right arm is gently wrapped under his neck. Lightly flicking the rope over the top of his head, our eyes are momentarily twinned in the same direction. There is an immaculate, glistening precision in the reflection of a horse's eye. The level of detail is startling and strikes one at first, brimming over the pupils of artistic imprecision, creative license. I can see the muse in it, the woman who taught Cormac McCarthy everything he knew about horses, smiling at me with a child's wise innocence. And I shyly try the hitch, looping and cinching the purple. I've been so afraid to tell my story, Britt tells me. It feels like I'm being disloyal to Cormac. I've always wondered, too, who would believe me? I guess I'm just more private than him. But he would always warn me that at some point his archives would open up and people would find out about me. Britt is correct. In the fall of 2025, the second half of McCarthy's archives, likely containing her letters to him, will become public at Texas State University. I know we joke around, calling Cormac a groomer. She can't help but crack a quick smile here before turning serious. But that's a defense mechanism of mine. I loved him more than anything. He kept me safe, gave me protection. He was everything to me, everything. He was my anchor. He was my world. He was my home. Even when we didn't live together anymore. Those things that happen to you, that young and that awful, you don't really heal. You just patch yourself up the best you can and move on. And Cormac gave me protection and safety when I had none. I would be dead if I didn't meet him. He was the most important person in my life, the person I love the most. He was my anchor, and now that he's gone, she pauses, I'm shiftless. Two eyes are not sufficient for a sunset in the west. That's because there is more than one sunset, more than can be seen in a single field of vision. After a monsoon, the sky is Sistine. To the west, lightning races the tousled embroidery of clouds in pink gilt. Turning on my heels, there are Iliads and Edens of violet cloudwork parted by the slimmest blue streamlets of sky. Soon the mountains will be darkened and skimmed of all their red and lilac, and they will stand like glowing geometry against the sunset's final yellow. It is all daubed in a nimbus around the muse, like a painting that is still wet, still open to being blended. I keep touching the Stella Maris medal in my pocket, which Augusta gave me earlier this morning, trying to keep track of all that loosened paint. She sidles up to me. You know, I had a dream about Cormac last night. Tell me about it. So, the town I grew up in North Dakota, had these big dikes by the Red River. We used to play there as kids. Back in the late 90s, the whole town flooded. A biblical kind of flood. The flood set off electrical fires, so whatever wasn't underwater caught on fire. I was at those dikes in my dream, and it was right before dawn. And it was so dark, and it was so hard to keep going. I felt that the bad men were coming. I didn't want to keep going anymore, and I decided I was just going to sit down and die. She laughs at herself. It couldn't be more simple. You just sit down and die. Isn't that how everyone does it? But anyways, as soon as I sat down, I noticed someone else was there. I looked up, and it was Cormac, and he said, "What are you doing over there, Baba?" And I told him, "I'm sitting down." Why are you sitting down? So I can die. Well, don't do that. Why not? And there were all these sections of color in the sky, like stained glass. Dawn was coming, and he was standing on the other side of the dikes under the color. Why don't you come over here where I am? He said. And I didn't know what to do. And then I woke up. Well, I think you do know what you have to do, I said, turning up my collar. She took a moment, looking at me under that stained glass western sky. That's right, she smiled, and she thrust her hand out before her the way McCarthy would have. Walk on. Red Hot. There's no one in Hollywood, or anywhere else probably, like Natasha Lyonne. Her wry-wrenching work in Poker Face, His Three Daughters, and Russian Doll has brought an indie favorite into the spotlight by Joy Press. With photographs by Camilla Akrans, styled by Celia Azoulay, showing Natasha Lyonne in various high-fashion looks. The high-spirited Natasha Lyonne, photographed in New York City on November 3rd. What's so amazing about having a moment is that they let you do stuff, says Natasha Lyonne, her halo of orange curls bobbing in the East Village twilight. It means your ideas are worthy of bankrolling and worthy of actually getting made. And it means the freedom to not have to hustle quite so hard. You don't have to go in and open your briefcase, show your wares, and have people say, "No, thank you, we're not looking for any stopwatches today." I've had decades of that. Lyonne lurked at the margins of Hollywood a long time, an eccentric with self-confessed niche appeal. But in recent years, she's moved closer to the center, or maybe the center has finally come to her. After creating the mind-bending Emmy-winning series Russian Doll, Lyonne scored a hit with the charming retro murder mystery series Poker Face, and was acclaimed last fall for her moving performance in His Three Daughters. Her days are now a frantic treadmill. Appearances in the upcoming Fantastic Four movie and Taika Waititi's Clara and the Sun, producing, starring in, and directing some episodes of Poker Face's second season, and developing projects for her own production company, Animal Pictures. I've had moments in life that have been lonely and dark, and broke enough where your priority is definitely not, "Did you pitch a TV show well this morning?" So if I hear myself being like I'm so tired, that means I've lost the gratitude for how extraordinary my circumstance is. Lyonne appeared in Pee-wee's Playhouse as a child and starred in Slums of Beverly Hills and American Pie as a young adult. Now 45, she looks back in anger rather than nostalgia. "I remember those years pretty well, against my will," she says in that raspy New York accent that sounds like a wise guy crossed with a borscht belt comedian. "There's something about being alert and in the workforce as a child. You can't put that genie back in the bottle. You can't unknow what you've seen." That sensation of being a commodity has informed everything she's done since. The second child of Orthodox Jewish parents, Lyonne grew up in New York and Israel against a backdrop of drinking sprees, fights, and general volatility. Her mother was an aspiring ballerina, her father a boxing promoter and radio shock jock who, she says, did things like calling into Howard Stern's show while she was a guest. All this made them what she diplomatically calls tricky stage parents. "You don't necessarily want to win at this thing that you're being told is a prize, so I was always trying to hide in the shadows. Since my parents' dream was for me to be famous, my whole purpose in life was to try to crush their dream by not doing that." Instead of getting her degree at NYU, she picked up a heroin addiction, and after she had kicked her habit, had open-heart surgery to repair the damage. After her parents died, circa Orange is the New Black, in which she played a junkie, she began to feel more comfortable being front and center as an actor. "I always dreamed of this fantasy place where I was able to do the thing I loved so much," she says, "but without this albatross on my back of being somebody else's funnel for cash." Now that she's arrived at this dream destination, Lyonne is reveling in her new freedom to stretch out in projects that tickle her imagination. It's like going off on this little adventure into this space that's not quite here or there. It's a third space, and we're all going to agree that it's real and live there for a while, she says. She breaks into a huge smile. "I'm pretty honest about that being my kink." For Russian Doll, she and her collaborators, Amy Poehler and Leslie Headland, assembled an all-female writer's room to invent a genre. As Lyonne booms in the deep tones of a movie trailer narrator, it was quantum physics meets trauma meets comedy. Her own character, Nadia, had a touch of the Philip Marlowe gumshoe about her, so it's not surprising to hear that Lyonne spent much of her youth in run-down New York theaters and YMCAs watching noir films. She eventually developed an internal voice that narrated everything she saw and experienced as if she were living inside a noir. I'm sure a therapist would just call it disassociating from trauma, she adds with a shrug. This dovetailed perfectly with Rian Johnson's notion of making a Columbo-style series. While Russian Doll's Nadia was trying to unravel her own existential mystery, Pokerface's Charlie ends up traveling the country as a fugitive, helping solve strangers' murders. Charlie loves people and can't help but get herself tangled up in helping them, Leone says. The character is witty and warm, putting people at ease as she drifts through unglamorous pockets of America. Leone says Charlie belongs to a classic American lineage of drifters who just hang out on the fringes of society as a witness, which reminds me of the way she describes herself to me, as the quiet one, sort of like the witness in her own family. I was always cataloging scenes and vignettes and tableaus. I did always think I would be able to write my way out of whatever nightmare I found myself in. That death as a primary motif in Poker Face and other recent projects is not a coincidence. I am endlessly, recklessly fascinated with the fact that we die at the end of our movie, no matter what we do, she says. You could not think of a more insane outcome to this whole gig than this finality. Leone, the rare actor who name-drops philosophers and actively wants to discuss string theory, points out that despite our being steeped in futuristic technology, we're still stuck in an actual lived experience where we have no idea when it'll hit. You could just walk down the street and a brain aneurysm or a bus hits you. All the more reason to enjoy her hot streak. Hopscotching Between Clara, which is based on a novel by Kazuo Ishiguro and a Marvel blockbuster. I'm very moved that they want me to be in that movie, Leone says of Fantastic Four, adding that she's known co-star Ebon Moss Bachrach for 25 years. Oddly enough, she sees dots connecting the movies. It is all very interstellar-type stuff, coming at it from different directions. Her eyes light up. I'm also in the Smurfs movie, she says, and actually some stuff does happen that's... I don't want to get into it, because I'll get in trouble. But assuming that I'm dead by 8:45 p.m. tonight, and they have to cut the movies together in a mashup, it will all marry well, I think. Leone has been so busy that success snuck up on her, but she's landed on the perfect amount of public recognition. People on the streets of New York treat her more like a good luck charm than a superstar, she says. I can get in anywhere, but also get lost anywhere. mask off. He spent his teen years concealing his sexuality. Now Benito Skinner is mining that awkward time for art by Rebecca Ford. Benito Skinner knows his way around a disguise. As his online alter ego, Benny Drama, he got famous for spoofing celebrities like Lana Del Rey and Kourtney Kardashian, while also creating original characters like Cooper, the Gen Z intern. Skinner's sharp but never cruel content was rewarded with a massive audience on YouTube and Instagram. When he began, Skinner was a Georgetown undergrad who'd grown used to wearing a different type of camouflage. Raised in Boise, Idaho, he spent much of his time and energy worrying that the whole world might discover he was gay. "I just remember the sense of doom everywhere I went," he says. But at 31, all of Skinner's masks are finally off. His new Prime Video show, Overcompensating, centers on a former high school football player who is desperately trying to fit in while struggling to accept his sexuality. Skinner didn't just create and write the series. He's also its star. "I really wanted queer people to see their experience and the complicatedness of that experience," he says. "Not that I don't think that exists, but I just feel like every time it was so much more complicated to come out than I've seen." Skinner attended Catholic school, where he realized that his love of choreography, of choreographing dance routines to Oops, I Did It Again, and his obsession with Pocahontas would not be welcomed. So he buried his interest in the arts and signed up for football instead. "You're in third grade and they're talking about sodomites being stoned to death," he says. "I'm like, I think I'm a little young for this, but I know that if I like men, I'm going to hell." While studying film at Georgetown, Skinner began to embrace performing and making his first videos. In 2018, he hosted his first live show during the New York Comedy Festival and began performing comedy in front of audiences instead of just on the internet. He also started to write a script based on his coming out journey and his relationship with his best friends. "We've seen that relationship being very high comedy," he says, "but I feel like these women saved my life and allowed me to finally discover who I am." While making the latest version of Overcompensating, now being produced by A24 and Amazon MGM Studios, Skinner scaled back on social media videos. Being an internet star wasn't always an easy gig, especially when it meant facing comments. "It's so easy to take a critique personally," he says. "Somebody commented once that I had super dry butthole lips, and I was like, well, that will now plague me for the rest of my life." Making Overcompensating allowed Skinner to create without all the extra noise. And while the show is centered on a queer journey, it also captures the universal desire to be accepted and loved. "I feel like the villain of the show in a lot of ways is this addiction to masculinity," he says. "I think that everyone feels that, not just queer people." Now based in L.A., where he lives with his boyfriend of 8 years, Skinner hopes to continue making the show. He says he's got at least 4 seasons in his head, but also to act in work by other creators. "I have a few things I'd love to do," he says. "I'd love to play just full-on straight. Can you imagine?" Thank you. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Ben Stiller, the Severance director, and not-so-secret Trekkie on Spock ears, becoming a triple threat, and the torment of being a Knicks fan. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I was shorter. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being in process on a creative project I love. What is your most treasured possession? The Spock ears that Leonard Nimoy gave to me. How would you like to die? Quickly. Which living person do you most admire? Filippo Grandi, United Nations Refugee Agency High Commissioner. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Self-doubt. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Self-importance. What is your greatest extravagance? My Star Trek memorabilia. What is your favorite journey? A road trip through the Northeast in the fall. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Practicality. On what occasion do you lie when I am trying not to hurt someone's feelings? What do you dislike most about your appearance? Don't get me started. Which living person do you most despise? That guy. What is your greatest fear? Losing my mind. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Like, you know, What is your greatest regret? Letting the past affect my enjoyment of the present many times over the years. When and where were you happiest? Probably as a small child in a pool in my mother's arms. Which talent would you most like to have? The ability to sing and dance well. What is your current state of mind? Present and hopeful. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Recognizing what I have and appreciating it. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? William Shatner. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Mitch McConnell's conscience. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? The 2014-15 Knicks. Where would you like to live? In a world without social media. What is your favorite occupation? Making a movie. What is your most marked characteristic? Durability. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty and unconditional love. Who are your favorite writers? George Saunders, Kurt Vonnegut, Salinger, Maurice Sendak, Jerry Stahl. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Jean Valjean. Who are your heroes in real life? MLK, Paul Farmer, Navalny, my father. What are your favorite names? Ebenezer, Andrikas, Elvis, Carlos, Rex, Emily, Sarah, Gwendolyn. What is it that you most dislike? Pain. What is your motto? Not YOLO. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Ben Stiller. Now this from Daisy Shaw Ellis. Good form, with a photograph by Ryan Jenk. Chanel watches. Long necklace couture. When working in her couturier, Coco Chanel often wore her fabric shears as though they were a pendant, dangling from a long ribbon around her neck. The ad hoc accessory serves as inspiration for this diamond-encrusted dress form on an 18-karat gold necklace. The miniature figure cleverly hides a watch face in the retractable waistline, proving that frivolity and luxury can be practical, too. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.